The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Yes, sir, you're listening on Thursday night or Saturday morning or on WGCORadio.com or possibly on the podcast as well. Lots of ways to listen. Today's going to be kind of a hodgepodge of sorts. Next week we'll have Mary Beth Franklin. Yes, she is the contributing editor of Investment News, past editor of Kiplinger Magazine and a friend of the show. She will be on next week. Lots of fun things to talk about. Her and I are lining out that agenda soon, and hopefully that'll be a great show. I know it will be because she's fantastic. Going to do a little bit on Social Security today. Also thinking about doing a 401k loan. What does that mean? Let's talk it through. When does it make sense? And when should you think no? We'll have Rod on to talk about where we are in the market and with flows happening in stock funds right now, coming back heavily. What's happening in bonds, and what does that mean for you and your 401k as well? But before we get to that, let's do a little tidbits of the week brought to you by, of course, Kenny Bland Auctions. They're your full-service auction service. They can do anything you want, but they'll offer the pre-planning, the sale of your estate or real estate. Visit them online, yes, at KennyBlandAuctions.com. Lance Like and the Like Law Group. Give yourself and your family the peace of mind that comes with proper estate planning. It happened this week with a couple that I met with. Call Lance at the Like Law Group, 812-323-8300. And finally, Unrivaled Electric. Thankfully, I have not had to use my generator much, but I have one, and they put it in. They also have solar arrays. They're veteran-owned. They want to be your electrician like they are mine. Give them a call at 812-361-3606. That's Unrivaled Electric. All right, this is interesting because we always wonder, right, how a person goes into Congress or the House of Representatives, just the Congress in general, and they don't have a lot of money, and they come out with a lot of money. Well, people don't trust them. 63% of over 2,000 registered voters surveyed in January of this year support a complete ban on stock trading for all members of Congress. You know, that's already in place for the Federal Reserve members. I'm not sure that'll go over very well. What's the Fed going to do? Well, as of Friday at noon, the bond market was priced to reflect a 55% chance that the Fed will raise short-term rates by a half a point and a 45% chance that they'll raise it by 0.75. So no one really knows. Right now it's pointing to 0.75 in most people's minds, but the bond market is saying, no, not, don't get ahead of yourself. And if they come in at 0.5, then guess what? The market will probably take off because the Fed will take a view that, hey, we're watching the data, things are relaxing, and all that good stuff, because the U.S. economy has contracted, according to the latest numbers, a little less than 1% for the second quarter on the heels of a 1.6% contraction in the first quarter of this year. That's the eighth time the United States has suffered two or more consecutive down quarters since 1960. It's crazy to think it's only been eight times, meeting that often used definition of recession. So officially, the U.S. has experienced nine recessions now since 1960. Boy, it sure feels like more than that, because I started doing this in 1994, and I feel like I've been through more than my share of these. In fact, I guess I've been through half of the recessions, or now, yeah, I guess half of them since 1960, and I've been doing it since 1994. So are they going to come around more often? I don't know. All right, what are we going to do about Social Security? Well, it must be done. The last time the Social Security normal retirement age was raised was in 1983 by good old Ronald Reagan. Tip O'Neill was involved as well. 75% of 2,500 registered voters surveyed in April supported raising the normal retirement age to protect the solvency of the program. Well, you know what they're going to say? Don't raise it on me. Because back in 1983, they raised it on people in some cases that weren't even born yet. So that's what will happen again. All right. Do you know a lot of people have debt, right? Well, the total household debt in the United States reached a record $16.15 trillion as of June of this year. 70% of the total is mortgage debt, which is not a big surprise. That's an all-time record. Housing prices are way up. Interest rates were down. So people borrowed a ton of money to buy that $700,000 house that they couldn't afford 3 years before. But believe it or not, over 23% of all U.S. households are completely debt-free. Let's hear your scream, as they say on The Ramsey Show. Just another trillion, right? The U.S. national debt has increased from 29.6 to 30.6 trillion, an increase of just a little over $1 trillion year to date. And we just are passing budgets that have more and more of that to come. You're going to have to get used to it, I guess, folks, and just realize that the reckoning day will come. I just don't know when it will come. I did a podcast on that last week, kind of laughed and made fun of, you know, the fact that, you know, Jesus Christ walked the earth, you know, 20 or was born like 2,600 years ago or something like that. You'll have to listen to it. It kind of puts things in perspective when you talk about dollars and days and debt. Has the housing market peaked? That's a great question. After reaching an all-time high of $475,000 average house in April of this year, new homes sold. Actually, it's fallen the last 2 months. Now the average price is $402,000. If you haven't been listening to me talk about this for the last year or more, that when interest rates go up, the amount of people can borrow go down, and that's how prices of houses work. It's always been that way. So probably the way it will always be. The average home price in the United States did increase 8.1% per year for the 10 years ending May of this year. That included, of course, an 18.3% increase in the just 1 year from last year to this year. So when you put that in perspective, American home prices increased just 1.4% per year for the last 10 years. So basically, we had a big front-end loaded price increase, but if you go back, you know, prices go up about 2% a year on average. It's the way it's always been. I was watching some TV last night, which my wife tells me not to because it gets me all worked up. But I was watching TV when they announced that California is trying to get basically 100% electric vehicles by some time in the future, like 2035 or something like that. But California right now, they had 563,000 electric vehicles registered as of 2021, or 39% of the U.S. total. So no other state has 100,000 registered electronic vehicles. So that's the big push because it all starts out west. So we'll see how it all ends up. I'm not sure our grid can handle all of this that we're asking for, but maybe that's when you have to step up and upgrade that as well. There's so many arguments back and forth. I don't know. I'm not an electric car guy. I still like fossil fuels. I like to hear my engine rev. So maybe an electric engine can give me that same feeling, that roar and that feel, you know. But for right now, I have planted a bunch of pine trees in my yard, so they need a little bit of carbon monoxide. So I'm still on board with that for now. But we'll see. My mind might change at some point. All right, what about spending money you don't have? Well, that's a great indicator of where we are on things today, because during the quote, pandemic, people were staying at home, not spending money, saving money, paying down debts. Well, as of June of 2003, credit card debt in the U.S. was almost three times the size of the student loan debt, right? And that's big news right now. And then by 2010, credit card debt was smaller than student loan debt. And as of June of this year, credit card debt, $890 billion, has been overwhelmed by the student loan debt of $1.59 trillion. Now, who's to blame for that? Well, there's a lot of going back and forth on that. People think the colleges have been, you know, raping us for years. I can't totally disagree with that. But then we came out this week, what we know so far, that we are in the midst of potentially forgiving about 10 grand of debt. And that has people up in arms, at least the people I've talked to. But now the cap will be awarded to borrowers making less than $125,000 a year. That's what we know so far. The administrative forbearance, meaning they don't have to make payments, was extended into December of this year. Pell Grant recipients will receive $20,000 in forgiveness. $10,000 in forgiveness will be awarded to all other federal loan borrowers. Borrowers may be eligible to reduce their monthly payments to 5% of their income, which was previously 10%. You know what? I don't have any student loan debt. I paid all that off years ago. Where's my 10 grand? I'm looking for it. Should I run my mailbox right now? I don't think so. Let's take a break. When we come back, you know what? People get, they're like worked up over, you know, what's happening in the markets and the economy. But have you seen what short-term T-bills are paying? Heck with a CD that's being advertised at 1%. What about a treasury bill, a treasury note, or a treasury bond? How do you buy them? When we come back, I'm going to tell you where we are on things today. This is Your Money with David Hayes. So what sparked this thought was I was looking through the HT the other day, and I saw an advertisement from a local bank saying 1% CDs on a 6 month or 1 year. I forget. It doesn't really matter, because I'm thinking, really? That's it? Well, don't forget, folks, the banks have a lot of money on deposit right now. They're trying to lend money that people don't want right now because rates are too high. So they're not going to pay you a bunch on your deposit to maybe or may not loan money out and get a good spread. But what about treasury bills, treasury notes, treasury bonds, right? What are those? What does it mean? Well, believe it or not, if you want to go out and purchase a 90-day T-bill from the U.S. government, which is considered the global risk-free rate, 90-day T-bill, as of the end of last week, 2.65%. You could buy a 6 month at 3.02, a 1 year at 3.1, a 2 year at 3.2. That's fully liquid and completely backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. That's crazy, right? That's considered the risk-free rate. But when you go out to 5 years and 10 years, the 5 years at 3.09, the 10 years at 2.98, and the 30 years just hovering a little above 3. So you're getting paid a lot more to take on a shorter amount of maturity. So people might think, okay, how does that relate to other things? Like mortgage rates. Well, mortgages are typically priced off the 10-year rate. Well, that's why we've seen mortgage rates kind of come down a little bit, because we've seen the 10-year drop below 3. Commercial loans, car loans, all of it's tied to some form of treasury. So what is the cost of money, right? And then they add on to that. Now, I've been looking at how do you buy this stuff, right? Well, you can actually go to treasurydirect.gov, buy that I-bond you've been dying to buy. You can only put 10 grand in. The interest is pretty well fixed for 6 months. There's a bunch of rules. You can read about it there. I've told you about it here on the show as well. But you can actually buy these other notes there as well. Now, if you're not comfortable with that, you can reach out to a financial advisor who has access to trading like that. And we've been doing it a bunch for people. People that just have had lazy money laying around. They don't want to mess with going to treasurydirect.gov. They don't know exactly how to buy it, where to hold it, all that kind of stuff. So I've been like, hey, let's charge them a quarter of a point to go out and get it for them, and you know, let them know when it matures and talk about what to do with it next. So, you know, there's opportunities out there, I guess I'm saying, to basically pick up some really, really good yields very, very easily. And, you know, yeah, the FDIC insurance is great, but who backs that? It's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So why not just go direct to the source and get the bond that's backing everything in this world, which is considered the treasury bill, a treasury note, or treasury bond. And there's a definition about all those, but they essentially are all the exact same thing. All right. Now, how does that relate to other fixed income? Well, if you're a high-quality corporate bond, you know, you're issued by a big major corporation, great credit, whatever, then you're going to pay a small spread over the risk-free rate. And it's kind of like, who would you rather be paying you interest, Walmart or the U.S. government? Well, Walmart is in much better shape than the U.S. government. But for some reason, we've accepted the fact that the U.S. government is a much better bet than Walmart. But nonetheless, Walmart has to pay you a little more than the U.S. government pays you. And that is dictated by these rates. So why would you want to go out and purchase something that's 10 years in maturity at a lesser rate than I can get over 2 years? Well, this happened to me in 1994. I first started in the business. I had just came out of an internship with Shearson Lehman Brothers, and that was something that I was trying to figure out as a young person. Why would anyone put their money in something that matures in 5 years and get paid less than something they get paid in 2 years? Well, the answer is rates are expected to go down. And 2 years from now, when your bond matures and you start to redeploy that capital, and you're like, oh, short-term rates are now only 1. Oh, and by the way, long-term rates are lower than they were before. That's the only reason you would go ahead and accept a 5-year bond paying less than a 2-year bond, because in 2 years, all the metrics might change, and it likely will. That's what the bond market's telling us. So what is the bond market telling us? That is an indication of growth and inflation. So we're saying basically inflation is high in the short run and low in the long run. So it's telling us exactly what the Fed is hoping to accomplish. And that's why the 10-year Treasury is under 3, the 30-year is just over 3, it's inflation plus something. You got to make something, right? And that's how you read the bond market. And I think now, finally now, after getting the Fed out of the buying business where they've artificially kept prices low for so long, we'll start to see the realities of how the bond market really is the best predictor of future growth and inflation. You know, when the U.S. government's the number one buyer of bonds, whether it be treasuries, mortgage backs, whatever, and they stop and then they become a net seller, well, what do you think is going to happen? Rates will go up. You heard it here on the show a year ago or less that this is exactly what's going to happen, and it's exactly what's happened. So we're not surprised by any of this. And later on, we're going to have Rod on to talk about where we go from here. In fact, he'll be on the next segment, and how we're looking at flows of money. Why does that even matter? Why does it matter where people are putting their money? Well, that means people are buying. If they're buying this area, guess what? Prices go up. If they're selling, prices go down. And what should you be doing versus what people are actually doing? That's always another thing we should be keeping our eye on. So when we come back, we'll grab Hot Rod. So get ready, because even though we only have him coined for about an 8-minute segment, it usually goes about 15 or 16. So get ready. Put the quarter in him. He's like the Energizer Bunny. Hot Rod is next. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Rod Holloway joins me now on the phone. Of course, a regular contributor to my show, but also Glass in the Afternoon on Monday and Friday. And I apologize for not calling in on Wednesday. I apologize to Glass, but I was in the middle of a meeting that I thought would end soon, and it didn't. So I had to continue on with the work of the day, which was helping people navigate a pretty complicated situation, and missed calling Glass in the Afternoon. But he forgave me and said I could still call back next week. So, Rod, I know we talk about things all of the time, but I was mentioning interest rates and where we are on things when it comes to growth and inflation and what the bond market's telling us. In the Wall Street Journal, let's see, it would have been a couple days ago, big article on investors return to stock funds, basically saying that people are now putting money heavily back into stocks. It's interesting because, you know, when we have this little summer rally that fizzled out a little, people were like, oh, yeah, it's now time to jump back in. And it almost seems like that's been investor behavior for as long as you and I have been around, that when things are going down, they don't want to put any money in. But when things start to look like they're going up, they want to jump back in. And it's that in and out, in and out, in and out. But I just wanted to get people aware of what's happening, what we believe is likely to transpire here over the next, you know, year or two, and just what to get ready for. And not that you want to change anything drastically, but definitely refocus in on what is happening, what do you need to do now to get ready for whatever it is that's coming up in your world, in your life, and just laying out some expectations. So you and I have had a lot of conversations about this, so I'll just turn it over to you from there.
Yeah, well, I think part of what you're alluding to when you talk about the fund flows and whether the market is on its way up or on its way down and how people feel about things. So the cycle of it going up, it's the FOMO, as people like to call it, the fear of missing out. Oh, gosh, I'm missing out on these gains, and they start diving in. Sometimes where that's an issue is their only analysis is what the market has been doing the last few days, the last couple of weeks, not necessarily a true valuation examination in which they dove into the market or the individual securities that they're buying and they said, oh gosh, this looks like a very good value. I want to buy it today. So we've discussed here in the office that during the tech bubble bursting, that over that period of time, you had 7-20% or greater rallies all on the way to dropping 70% from the peak high. So just simply because the market starts to go up, isn't an automatic signal that the market's going to continue to go up. So what people really need to do is they really need to be assessing what they need the money for, what the time horizon of that is, and how much risk they're really willing to take in regards to achieving those potential goals. On the equity side, those should be long-term dollars. Those should be dollars you don't plan to need in 6 months, not a year, probably not even for maybe 3 to 5 before you would tap in, depending on the type of stock and the safetiness and the volatility that goes with it. But really, like when we segment our clients' money, and especially in preparation for retirement, that long-term dollar, we're talking 10 to 15 years before we mm-hmm. need to tap into it. So from that standpoint, we're not trying to overly time in the short run, is this the very bottom and let's get in. Let's get in and slowly add to it, and then potentially if we see better buying opportunities, have some possible dollars that we can reallocate over there, or maybe some that we're just setting on the sidelines looking for a good opportunity. I think right now, as far as where we go just in general in the marketplace, we're kind of at an inflection point. You've got a large contingent that is most certainly setting up that June was the low. We've seen the low. We've also seen peak inflation, and that was the 9.1, and that everything from this point forward only gets better. But you've also got a similar size contingent on the other side that says, look, things are just starting to really slow down and come down meaningfully as far as demand and economic activity goes. But outside of the commodity world, we haven't seen a whole lot of depreciation in prices, most certainly in the grocery stores. A lot more of it is tied to large ticket purchases, homes, new construction and commercial buildings, automobiles, those types of things. Well, those are great things that drive the economy, but those aren't the things that every person has to do every day, every week, every month. The other things we have to deal with on a regular basis are the things that we haven't seen much come down in prices as of yet. But as we sit here and move forward, that's really going to be the crux of what determines how the rest of this year goes, and potentially as we tap into 2023. Are we really seeing inflation begin to roll over and have a meaningful descent, meaning the Fed could be done sooner than later in their interest rate rises? Or is inflation sticky? And does it kind of just hover at an area somewhere between 4% and where the last reading was, which came in at 8.5, because the Fed has told us they wanted it too. Mm-hmm. So they don't plan on stopping raising interest rates until they get at least much closer to 2. I'm not saying it has to be 2 exactly, but I'm pretty certain they're probably not stopping at 6. And there's a lot of smart people that are setting up on both sides of the aisle that have some pretty solid arguments that go with it. My only concern on the arguments on the inflation has peaked side, I do believe they're hanging their hat on a lot of things related to big ticket items, which once again, there's only so many people looking to buy a new house. There's only so many people looking to buy a new car. Everybody has to go to the grocery store. Everybody has to get those consumer staples, the Kleenexes, the paper towels, all of those mm-hmm. things on a consistent and regular basis. And until those areas begin to show some price relief to the consumer, yeah, then I don't know that everybody is in as good a shape as maybe what is being alluded to from that side of the aisle. I'm rooting for them to be right. But I need to see some proof before that I'm going to jump on their bandwagon and say, okay, we've seen peak inflation. The Fed will be out of the game relatively soon. It's not going to be in September. They're most certainly increasing rates in September. But maybe it doesn't carry into 2023 like some people are alluding to, and maybe they don't actually have to get restrictive with their interest rate policy.
Well, I think right now I reported in News of the Week that there's a 55% chance, according to the bond market, that the Fed will jump by a half a point, and a 45% chance a three-quarter point rise. But either way, it's an increase. And I think, like you said, Rod, the market's been a little bit optimistic on where we are in things today. But I did a piece before you came on how short-term rates are really high, long-term rates are lower. So the long-term curve, end of the curve, is saying to us lower inflation, lower growth. So it's saying what the Fed is hoping to accomplish, but we're certainly not there yet. And to your point, home prices across the country have decreased You know, from a median of 457,000 to 402 as of June. A lot of things like that have started to roll over. So here we sit. I think you and I are both in the same camp that many times we always say that when you think it can't get any worse, it usually does. I think that's kind of where we are on things, that, yeah, the June lows may or may not be where we set a stake in the ground. But I think you and I are both in the same camp that don't be surprised if we go back and hit those again as the reality of what the Fed's trying to do and will do settles in, right?
Yeah, most certainly, because it is common from a technical pattern perspective to go back and retest lows. Now, normally you would have thought you'd have done that a little bit sooner than what we have as far as that June and haven't done it as of yet. But if the premise of this rally off of the June bottom is that the Fed will be done sooner than later and that inflation is going to start dropping fast, well, then we're going to have to see that in the numbers, because if August doesn't tell us that same story and then September and then October, then all of a sudden you've got a whole new dynamic that the market has to begin pricing in, which is, hey, we thought that the Fed was wrong and would have to admit they were wrong and would change what they're telling us, which they keep telling us, we're nowhere close to being done raising interest rates. And then if that's the case, then the market has to reevaluate what are we willing to pay from a price to earnings multiple on this marketplace for a market that hasn't seen the top of Fed interest rates yet, in addition to the pain felt due to inflation, has not subsided and will not subside for a little while yet.
Rod Holloway has been my guest. And of course, Rob, we always appreciate you taking the time in the middle of the day as we record early on a Thursday afternoon. And so we'll listen for you tomorrow afternoon on Big Show Friday with Glass in the afternoon to put a stake in the ground for this week. So thanks again, Hot Rod.
You bet. Have a great show, Dave.
All right, guys, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I did a podcast on the granddaddy of them all, which was Social Security as far as retirement income planning goes. I just want to take a few minutes and go through some of the basics of Social Security, some of the myths that a lot of you have in your minds that are not true, and maybe a little different way to think about a couple things. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, it's crazy that most Americans are still taking Social Security at 62 or 63. Now, why are they taking it? Do they need the money? Maybe. Does it make mathematical sense? Possibly. But how do the numbers really line up? You know, if you take your money at 62, the crossover point versus waiting to 66, if that happened to be your full retirement age, is about age 78. If you wait until 70, get those delay credits. Remember, you get inflation plus 8% a year delay credits if you wait till 70. Well, then your crossover is different. If between 62 and 70, it's about 80 and a half years. Between 70 and your full retirement age of 66, it's about 82 and a half. So you're thinking, oh man, my family history stinks. I'm not very healthy. But the question is, are you married? Because if you're married, that changes the dynamics. So if I'm married, it now becomes the family benefit. It's not your benefit, it's the family benefit. It's the largest benefit becomes the family benefit. So that's why almost always, if you have the resources to get you through the hump between retirement and age 70, the highest income earner generally would want to wait to 70. Because again, that becomes the family benefit. So let's say you did die at 82, but you're married and your spouse lives to 92. It was her benefit or his benefit. So you have to look at things differently. Don't look at it as just your benefit. Look at it from a tax perspective. Again, current tax law says, and that can always change, that 85 for most people, if you have any quality standard of living, about 85% of your benefit is subject to federal tax. So not all of it's taxable. The second piece, it's not taxed at the state level. So it's inflation adjusted. You get this massive increase if you wait, and it's not fully taxable. That is the basics of how this thing works. Now, you might be saying, well, Social Security trust fund is going to go broke in 2030, whatever, three, and we're only going to get 70 or 77 cents or whatever they say of the amount promised. Well, let's think about that for a second. How are they going to fix this? Well, currently, we only pay Social Security taxes, and it's a payroll tax, up to, in 2022, $147,000. Now, what about Medicare? Well, Medicare is kind of in the same boat. They're on the ropes as well. But a married couple, after you hit $250,000, then you quit paying Medicare taxes. So what are they going to do? They're going to increase the taxable wage base on Social Security from probably $147 to $250. When that happens, that solves a lot of problems. Does it solve them all? No, but it certainly kicks the can way down the road. And then what about raising the age? I mentioned in News of the Week that most people think we should, because remember when this rule was set many, many years ago, but the age of 65, the average life expectancy was less than that, and even if you lived into retirement, you didn't live much longer than that. But then we changed the rules and said, okay, let's extend it out. In 1983, we said, let's push this thing out up to age 67. Well, for those age that are going to be 67 when they qualify, that's me, right? In 1983, how old was I? 13 years old. Did I care? No. Did I vote? No. So that's why when they change these rules, it probably won't affect many of us who are, you know, within, you know, maybe a stone's throw, maybe a catapult throw to Social Security. So these things will get fixed. It's just going to take someone to have some guts to step up and do some serious reform. Now, a lot of folks are like, okay, I understand the taxation, but what about if I do take it earlier than full retirement? Well, if you take it earlier than full retirement and you still work, you're going to have some earnings limitations. But once you hit full retirement age, which for most of you listening are probably, you're either on Social Security or it's 66 or between 66 and 67, then once you hit that age, you can earn whatever you want. Now, what does earn mean? Because a lot of folks are like, well, what does that mean? That does not mean withdrawals from your retirement account. It does not mean interest or dividends on investments. It doesn't mean a lot of things. But what it does mean is, welcome to Walmart. How may I help you? That's a job, right? You get a W-2. Potentially, you know, a K-1 if you're an active participant in a business, that would be considered earned income as well. But that's the concern that I would have for anyone taking it before full retirement age, at least. The other thing is, you got to be thinking about other things like widow benefits. If you've been married 2 years and your spouse passed, you're eligible, and there's a different claiming strategies for you. You could take your deceased spouse, you know, whenever you're eligible, 62 or full retirement, whatever. And then delay yours to 70. We have that happen all the time. If you did have a deceased spouse and you decided to get remarried and you had not started Social Security yet, well, your deceased benefits go away. So I always laugh about this because you can have deceased benefits as early as age 60. Well, I had a client that had been, her husband had been passed away for 15 years. She was 59 at the time. She had met a new person a couple years before and they decided we're going to get married. So I mentioned to her about when, you know, would be an ideal time to get married. And they were going to have a spring wedding. And I said a fall wedding would be much nicer, not because of the weather and the foliage, but because you'll be 60, we can trigger your benefit, and your new marriage will not affect you. So these are these little things that come up, right? What about if you are on Social Security and you're kind of maybe on that second marriage and you had younger kids? Well, that might make a difference when you start Social Security, because when you start claiming, your kids could start claiming. Right? There's so many different things to think about. So when you just think about Social Security in the simplest form, it's not all about you. It's about family benefits, right? It's about divorce is another one, right? Where was I married 10 years and then got divorced? Well, then I'm subject or eligible for my ex-spouse's benefits as well. Does that affect his or her benefit? No. So there's so many moving parts with Social Security, and it truly is, in my opinion, the granddaddy of them all. Because that supplies a significant amount of income for most people in retirement. It's inflation adjusted. If you play your cards right, you can maximize it for you and your family. But just don't think of Social Security in a simple way. It's not simple at all. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, I'm dealing with this with a family member right now. They've been thinking about taking a 401k loan and whether that's a good idea or not. So let's talk through it. When does it make some sense? When should you think, no, that does not make any sense? We'll be back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Yes, many people have 401ks. Most of you have 401ks. Most of you have something called a loan privilege. And what does that mean? Some would say you should never take a 401k loan. Never. And I'm always like, come on, never. That's I hate those blanket statements where people say you should never do this, you should never do that. Well, there's certain things you should never do. There's some things in the Ten Commandments you probably should never do. But generally speaking, financially, there's things that you should sometimes consider. And a 401k is one of them. So what can you do? How does it work? Well, if you have money in a 401k, you can borrow up to, for most people, 50% or $50,000, whichever is greater. And that's been a rule that has been around for as long as I can remember, 20 plus years, that this is the federal rules on 401k loans, which is interesting, right? This is another example of something that's never kept up with inflation. Should it be $100,000? Should it be $200,000? I don't know. But generally, you must pay that back over 5 years. Now, it could be longer if you're doing it to purchase a home or something else. And this is truly a loan. So who are you borrowing from? Well, you're borrowing from yourself. I'm taking a loan against my 401k, which is interesting because you cannot loan against an IRA. I keep going back. There's so many differences between 401ks and IRAs, but that's a story for a different day. But you cannot borrow against an IRA, but you can your 401k. We've had situations where we've rolled money into a 401k to take a loan because it's tax-free. It's money I can use for what I need it to do, and then I can pay it back over 5 years. But when is it a good idea? Are you using it to pay off a credit card only to charge it back up again, even though you say you won't? That's probably a bad idea. Home repairs, buying a car, a piece of real estate, maybe that's okay. If you don't have the cash to do it, maybe you go to your 401k and borrow it. So who gets this money, right? You get the money tax-free as a loan, and then through payroll deduction, you pay it back. It goes right back to you. It's usually some assumed interest rate. So I always say, listen, it's like you thinking to myself, I no longer have this $50,000 invested in this fund. It's now invested in me, and I'm going to pay it back. Now, what if you're close to retirement or you leave the job? What happens? Well, if you leave, they'll send you a payment booklet. You can keep making payments on it. If you leave and don't want to pay it back through retirement or some other reason, then it's called, and I hate this word, a default. What does that mean? It becomes taxable to you. So is that a big deal? Maybe or maybe not. If you're under 59.5, yes, it is a big deal because now it's taxable, early distribution, and a 10% penalty. If you're retired, maybe it's not a big deal. You, quote, default on it, meaning you don't pay it back. It becomes taxable to you, but you're over 59.5, maybe that's not a big deal. So I think it's just good to understand what a 401k loan is, how does it work, when should you use it, and when should you not. Now, are you going to borrow off your 401k to take a vacation? No. Are you going to borrow it to, instead of borrowing from the bank? Maybe, right? That might make some sense. But don't borrow to pay for a steak you had 2 years ago. That's a bad idea because you're not going to solve the habits that got you into the situation you're in. It's a bailout. It's almost like refinancing your home. People do that all the time to pay off credit card debt. It's a good idea if you change your habits, if you change what got you into the mess you're in. But unfortunately, most people don't change. It's an easy way out, so they don't change their habits and they get right back into the mess. So now I have a 401k loan, I have a higher mortgage, and I have credit card debt. I think there's a process that your mind goes through when you work through something. You work through getting out of debt by doing the avalanche, the snowball. Pick the method you want to get out of debt. But when you get through it, you're like, I don't want to do that again. But if you just go simply refinance your home, your payment goes up by 50 or 80 bucks a month, you pay off 20 or 30 grand of credit card debt, you're like, oh, that was easy. But guess what? Didn't teach you anything. And we're all that way. Our minds are wired a certain way, and you've got to understand how you're wired, how you got in the situation you're in, and just don't do it again. And I know it sounds simple, but it's not. So don't do yourself what you think is a favor by going and taking a 401k loan to pay off stuff that you spent money on years ago, and you can't even tell me what you spent it on. But maybe you pick it out to do things like get your kid through college, or you are trying to get some home repairs done because you don't have the money, but you can certainly get the HVAC done or the plumbing done, which is my family member's case, right? And then you have a systematic way of paying it back. Maybe you can work some overtime, get a little extra towards the loan, get it taken care of. So there are good reasons to take out a 401k loan, but you need to understand what you're taking the money out for, what it's going to be used for, and just make a good decision. And if you think you need to bounce it off of someone, bounce it off of someone. And remember, my rule of thumb is don't take advice from broke people, because that's the number one thing that gets people in trouble. All right, that was fun. We'll come back, wrap up the big show, It's Your Money with David Hayes. You know, I had someone in this week in the office who I never met before. They were referred in to us. They had a situation that needed to be dealt with, so they had me come in, and I always enjoy solving problems, and that's what we were attempting to do. And she said, are you the guy on the radio? And I said, yeah, I am. I've been doing it for over 20 years. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, she goes, I've never listened. And I go, well, that's okay. She goes, well, my husband never misses. And she said, he really enjoys listening to you. He thinks you're funny. And I said, oh, that's good, because I think I'm funny too. Do you not hear me laugh at myself all the time? I'm literally sitting in the car sometimes, and I don't listen to my own show. But I'll think of a thought and start laughing out loud. And Jimmy Valvano said, is I say that right? Yeah, Jimmy V. He, during his speech in the ESPY Award, he said, you have to laugh every day. You need to cry every day, right? And that fulfills you. Well, I don't necessarily cry every day, but I certainly laugh every day. I probably cry more than I should over emotional things. My buddies think that I have low testosterone, but I just think it's, you know, I'm emotionally, you know, vested in things, emotionally invested in people. But they would say it's a chemical imbalance. But whatever, I'll take it either way. And maybe you laughed at that, maybe you didn't, maybe you resemble this, maybe you don't resemble that. But either way, I have this forum, and I love it, and I appreciate it very much, and I enjoy all of you that listen. If you missed any of the show, you can catch it, you know where, Saturday mornings at 9 a.m., always on WGCLRadio.com, or possibly on the podcast, which is a really easy way. And then next week, Mary Beth Franklin, the contributing editor of Investment News. She is the guru on Social Security, Medicare, and more. We'll have a lot of fun with her as well. So look forward to that next week, and have a great weekend, everyone. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.